how soothing. That's what we need, a night of despair and despondency. Dorothy, before I introduce you formally, can you deal with depression on a global scale as well as the individual sufferer? Are you there, Dorothy, or are you too depressed to talk to me? No. We can't hear you, Dorothy. There's a bit of a worry. Whilst Paul fiddles with the knobs and we seek aid from the Queen, I think, to speak to Buckingham Palace, she usually sorts things out. Let me tell you what I hope you're going to hear, and that's a chat with Dorothy Rowe, who's very much, I hope she'll forgive me for saying this, my sort of girl. She's a scientist and that she doesn't go for alternative medicine or therapies, but she's not all that keen on the increasing psychiatric dependence on pharmaceuticals to treat emotional problems. She actually likes to chat with her patients. She's an Australian psychologist and she's known worldwide for her best-selling book on depression, in which she combined the aforementioned scientific clarity with compassion and common sense to show people a way out of that particular prison. When she talks to her patients, it's not only about their problems, but about their philosophy of life, which I'm told is unusual in a psychologist. But for her, it's essential because she says that our ideas about life and death, the afterlife, about good and evil, are the window to our sense of self, and that much of our unhappiness stems from having, an insecure sense of self. Now, I profoundly, passionately agree with her about our difficulties with death and about the way we manage to deny it for very bad psychological and, I think, finally social outcomes. Anyway, the insights gained from her discussions with people in pain appear in a new book, What Should I Believe? And it's subtitled, Why Our Beliefs About the Nature of Death and the Purpose of Life Dominate Our Lives. But as I can see from the stricken and anguished expressions on my colleagues on the other side of that big sheet of glass, this is not happening yet. Can I have an update, my dears? We're going to play a sting, which is our way of being desperate, while we try to work out what the hell to do. This is nothingness as advertised. Just to keep you posted, dear listeners, what's happened is that London has had a complete Chernobyl meltdown. That's just the BBC, not London in its entirety. So we're trying to get Dorothy in proximity to a mobile phone, having gone to all that trouble to book her into the London studio. But we'll play some more music whilst you have a panic attack. Well, no news, and it's not good news. In 20 years of doing this program, this is the first time we've actually had a total collapse of connection. I could probably do Dorothy's bit as well, couldn't I? I could affect a female or a feminine voice. What's happening, my dears? Am I going to run from the studio towards the gap? Dorothy, are you there?
I'm there. Oh, can you hear me?
Dorothy, darling. Oh, what a woman. I knew you wouldn't let me down. Could you hear all the nice things I was saying about you earlier?
Yes, indeed. Well, I heard some of them, and the rest of the time I had my head out of the studio screaming at somebody.
Now, look, take this pill, Dorothy. I don't have time for the talking cure. Just pop a pill. Now, you would say, as I certainly do, that it's not just psychiatric patients who would benefit from examining their beliefs about life and death. Why are we so good at, skilled at not doing this?
Well, I always say the church keeps me in business because people are taught to feel guilty and feel frightened. And so I've written a lot about religion in other of my books, you know, like Depression, The Way Out of Your Prison.
I think when they burn you at the stake, I'll be on the next pile of faggots. I think we'll go up together, you and I. Will you agree?
Well, other day I was on the World Service talking with a devout Christian, and I said much the same thing. I expected to be burnt at the stake. And she assured me that Christians have never burnt anybody at the stake. So...
Well, I'm not sure. I have to speak to a criminologist about that. I was on the understanding that it had happened quite often. Look, before we get into the fuss of the book, there's something I'm busting to ask you. You have a small skill from your Australian childhood. You say that within a couple of minutes you can tell, or you could tell as a child, if someone you met was a mick or a proddy.
Oh, now, yes.
Can you still do that?
I found that I wasn't using skill. I didn't need it when I came to England. But when I start to go over to Northern Ireland, fairly often, it all came back to me. You know, how many children, what's their surname, where they went to school.
Oh, well,
and
I wish
I didn't remember all this.
Oh, I thought you just intuitively knew in a nanosecond, or there was a funny handshake or something.
No, there are all those sort of things, and I'm sure there's a lot of stuff I've forgotten. But at that time, I was finding that Catholics and Protestants got depressed differently. Neither was better than the other, but that came out of the kind of religion that they had been taught.
Now, Dorothy, I would agree with you that religion, amongst other things, but principally religion, is one of the reasons people don't confront or clearly confront their own mortality or exploit its wonderful sort of exuberant impact on life itself. But, of course, it's not just the religious who avoid discussing these immense topics. Almost even my fellow atheists don't do it too often.
Well, nobody likes talking about dying. That's the thing. We'd like to pretend that other people die, but not us. And it's just unknown. I know religious people say, oh, well, our soul or our spirit continues on. But that's just a guess. It's a fantasy.
Well, it's more than that. In many people I've spoken to, right up the church hierarchy, I find that it's an ambit claim. It's something they would like to be true, but they don't necessarily, or they're not necessarily convinced that it is.
No, because there are so many doubtful things about it. Once you start to think of the actual detail, over the past two or three months, I've been talking about my new book, and so various people are questioning me, like religious people, and I get asked, but surely you believe in heaven? And I say, I think about an eternity with my mother. No, it was enough.
My old mate Malcolm Muggeridge once told me that he didn't think people should be allowed to have painkillers as they approach the end because that robbed them of the wonderful experience of dying. And I said, well, that's fine for you, Malcolm, but my auntie certainly wanted some pain-killing, thank you very much. Is there any value in suffering? This is often argued by religious people. Can it, in your experience or your observation of it, can it make us better people?
If suffering improved us, our human species would be the most wonderful species the world's ever seen. Kind, generous, loving, wise. Because our species has suffered from the moment we appeared on this planet.
I think you're saying the answer is no.
The answer is no. So, you know, some people learn from their suffering. They learn from their experience. And, you know, you often hear people say of depression, for instance, well, it was just terrible, but I wouldn't have missed it for the world because I'm much wiser now. And because people like that don't get depressed again. But most people don't learn from their suffering. They endure it, and then they're left with anger and resentment, which carry on, you know, which you can see like in the Middle East from one generation to another.
I'm often told by believers that, you know, that God at least provides a sort of anesthetic for suffering, but it often makes it worse because if you feel let down, if you feel that you've done all the right things religiously and calamities still occur, then you've got a problem. I remember being in Bali decades ago after a major earthquake, and I was taken to the ruined villages by a wonderful Catholic priest, Hannibal Aprandi, and he made the point that these people did every day of their lives, did little sacrifices, little profferings, little religious gestures to prevent this happening. And when it happens, there's nothing left. Have you, in your experience, seen people suffer more because they feel their faith or indeed their God has betrayed them?
Yes, indeed, because all religions teach the belief in the just world. In a just world, good people are rewarded and bad people are punished. Nothing happens by chance. And that creates this huge problem of why do bad things happen to good people?
Now, that's a question you're asked a huge amount, isn't it? And how do you answer it? How do you answer it as a therapist? Clearly, you have to answer it with some compassion.
If you believe that we live in a just world and if you're striving to be good, then you're the person that has to ask the question, why has this happened to me? And if you don't allow for chance, the only way you can answer that question is, in the whole scheme of things, it's either my fault or somebody else's fault.
And yet you and I would believe it just is.
Yeah, things happen. We don't live in a just world. There's no grand design of rewards and punishments. Things happen by chance. But so many people find that too scary.
What do you do, Dorothy, when someone is intent on finding a reason for living? In other words, a purpose to life. Once again, I tend to think that these are the wrong questions. But what do you do when someone addresses them to you?
I don't think a small child needs a purpose in life because the child is interested in everything. But what happens to so many of us is that we're punished for being interested in everything, or terrible things we don't understand happen to us. And we get the feeling that it's our fault, you know, we're being blamed. You know, adults often blame children for what was an accident. You know, you're a bad boy, you just broke that cup. When actually,
they'd say that to me every day here at the ABC. I'm always being blamed for everything. I'll be blamed for the technical problems before. I'll be smacked after this broadcast.
Yes, well, we always like somebody we can blame. You serve a useful purpose to all your colleagues. But what happens with so many of us is that you feel bad inside and that horrible feeling spills out into the world and you lose that joy in everything around you. And when we lose that joy, we then ask, well, why am I living? What's the purpose? Mm. And so you have to manufacture some purpose. Whereas if you could only kept that original feeling, it's wonderful to be alive. It's so interesting.
And I always tell people about living in a meaningless universe and how I've always dealt with mortality. I say the fact of death is a great aphrodisiac for living.
Yes, it is indeed. It certainly is.
Because if death didn't exist, almost all our, well, apart from no need for science or medicine, all our religious structures would evaporate. You know, you actually do need death as the great definition.
Yes, and death makes us choose. If you didn't die, the only choice you'd have to make would be, in what order would I do this or that and the next thing? But you'd have time to do everything.
At least twice.
At least twice. Whereas, you know, you've got to fit it in. Death says make a choice. And sadly, when you choose one, the others are excluded.
I still have some sympathy. You know, I'm not the sort of atheist that goes around ranting at people and telling them they're all idiots. I might think that, but I don't go around actually saying it. So I have some sympathy for people who become, for example, happy clappers, as American-style evangelism rampages through parts of Australia. It must be quite fun to having escaped the sort of the doldrums of Catholicism or the boredom of Anglicanism. And you go to some great mega church and you dance around and wave your arms in the air.
The people I think have really got it sorted are the evangelicals, who are taught by their preachers that if they give their life to Jesus, Jesus will make you rich. Now, this must have been a different Jesus from the Jesus I was taught about it.
Well, if it's true, he should be at the G20 conference, shouldn't he, sorting out the... We need him to sort out global depression.
Yes, but what about that Jesus who was always on about camels through eyes of needles and sell what you have, give your money to the poor?
That's right. But he was the communist Jesus. We had to get rid of him and have a capitalist Jesus, you see.
That's true.
You're not going with the flow here, Dorothy. I'm talking to Dorothy Rowe. Thank heavens I'm talking to Dorothy Rowe. Yes, I said heaven. Psychologist and author who disappeared in a puff of smoke, but who is now back in the arms, in the bosom of our little radio family, and Dorothy's telling us what should we believe. I want to sort of, this is a bit tricky, what has been your own personal journey? Were you born wise or was wisdom thrust upon you?
I was born into a family where you either had to work out what was going on or go crazy. But if ever I say, well, I was faced with a choice of going crazy or becoming a psychologist, my son immediately says, what's the difference?
But was your family of conventional religious persuasion?
No, my mother always worried about what the neighbours thought, and she sent me to Presbyterian church and Sunday school. But she didn't go herself because she didn't want some man telling her what to do. And whereas my father, he might have been brought up conventionally, but he went as a soldier in the First World War to France. And there he lost whatever beliefs he might have had. And he came back an atheist and a socialist.
There are no atheists in the foxholes, they say. I would have thought it's a great place to manufacture atheists.
Indeed, yes.
Okay, Dorothy, keep going.
Have I got time to... You know, Dad used to read the Ralph... name's gone. There was this great atheist lecturer, and Ralph Ingersoll.
Yes,
and
wonderful
he'd read fellow. Ingersoll's essays out aloud. And so I'd listen to all this, and then I'd go off and listen to the minister and have Ingersoll's criticisms ready in my mind. So I learnt all about Presbyterianism, but none of it stuck. I didn't believe it. And I couldn't pretend to believe, because even then I knew the dangers of lying to yourself.
Dorothy, you are gifted in another way. You have a sense of humour. How important is that as a survival technique or a path to wisdom? Or indeed, how important is it as a therapist?
It's very, you know, it's a survival technique. When there's nothing else you can do about your situation, you can laugh at it. And people with a sense of humour do a lot better. I don't mean that real bitter sense of humour that a lot of depressed people get, or paranoid people get.
Or the person who sends me these little notes I read out on air that come in a in the strange little envelope. There's a bitterness and an anger in there which is seething. Now, no sense of humour.
No, but it just adds the joy of life. I was saying to an audience on Friday that I, unlike Richard Dawkins, the great militant atheist here, I don't want to see religion disappear because I find it so entertaining.
Me too. I've said that to Richard. He's a real grump sometimes. And Christopher Hitchens is even worse. You know?
Yes.
Okay, now tell me why you persist, you funny old-fashioned thing, with talking to patients instead of just giving them a pill.
Because pills don't work. That's straightforward. Even the psychiatrists have accepted that now. You know, antidepressants don't really work. They mitigate some symptoms, but they don't cure depression because there isn't an illness of depression. It's a result of the way in which we see ourselves and our world. And the only way you can sort that out is by talking, and not in a real simplistic way. You know, there's a whole lot of cognitive behavioural therapy that is can be helpful, but in training, getting people to listen to how they think. But, you know, life's too... It's complex because there are so many insolvable dilemmas. There are so many opposites that we have to live with.
Dorothy, in the talking cure that you use, do you talk or just listen? That's one of the things that fascinated me about the classic talking cure, that it was so one-sided.
Well, Freud did an awful lot of talking, and sometimes you talk to keep yourself awake. But it's... the kind of talking that I do is talk about aspects of my life experience only to illustrate that where I'd had an experience somewhat similar to an experience my client had had, I would just be illustrating there was an alternative way of interpreting things. Like, you didn't have to take your mother 2,000% seriously. You could actually joke about her. And a lot of people found that just terrible. You know, you can make jokes about God, but not about your mother. But, you know, that sort of talking.
Yeah.
Just to show alternative ways of seeing things.
Mm. And you find that over a period of time it works.
With some people, look, if a person doesn't want to change, they're not going to change because there are secondary gains in lots of situations and that people don't want to give them up. And people, you know, are often frightened of changing because you don't know what's going to happen. And I've had a client say to me, Dorothy, well, you say I can give up being depressed, but if I do, will you promise me I'll never be unhappy again?
Well, you can't make that promise.
Come into the real world, you're always going to be unhappy about something.
Yes, my heart goes out to poor Woody Allen, who's been in therapy, as you know, for about 200 years, but I feel even more sympathy for his therapist. Even Woody Allen, as amusing as he is, it must get intolerably boring on his 50-minute hours, thousands upon thousands of them as he drones on and on, really. How do you cope with that?
Because your clients come to you saying, please take the pain away, but don't change me. And so you have to convey to them that the pain is them and that it won't go unless they change. And then you start talking about their childhood and outcomes, all the terrible things that have happened, and the client can actually be kept in that state because we can never come to the end of all the times when we've been badly treated by someone or other. And that's where Woody's therapists have kept him all his life, and he's made some
amusing films as a consequence, but boy.
That's right. You know, he's not going to stop it.
No.
But, you know, the person is, your client is saying, why has this happened to me? And the answer is, why not?
I know that's the answer. I know that's the answer. I think if I was in your job, I'd sometimes just get a bit grumpy and yell at people, but I suppose you can't do that. Dorothy, it's lovely to talk to you. It's been a bit difficult because you wouldn't talk to me before, but I forgive you. I do. And I urge people to read your book. Dorothy's book is called What Should I Believe? Why Our Beliefs About the Nature of Death and the Purpose of Life Dominate Our Lives. It's a very long title, but it's a very good book, and it's published by Routledge. On our next, yes, Bruce Shapiro, after glowing with President-elect Barack Obama, and we're going to talk to the former executive director of the World Food Programme, James Ingram, on how Australia can help with the world's food security and what happened to the Australian servicemen and their families who were sent to Japan following the end of World War II. I don't know about you, listeners, but I'm now suffering from presidential campaign deprivation, and I'm going to pretend the election is still going on and we'll keep discussing the primaries for at least another 6 months. That's my form of therapy. That's it for now. Stick around for the news on Radio National, and we'll see you later.